Welcome to Catholic Messenger Conversations. Our partner, again, conversation partner, is Bishop Dennis Walsh. He's still a newbie, right?
Correct.
Kind of still a baby bishop, would you say?
Find my way through this whole thing.
That's right. Okay, so you just returned from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, but also a clergy overnighter with our Diocese of Davenport priests. I think that was your first one, right?
Correct, yep. So it's been a long week and a half of travel. I started probably Thursday before the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops and went to visit a religious sister friend of mine in New Jersey, then went down to Baltimore for the USCCB meeting, and stopped in Toledo and Delphus and my former parishes, my former diocese for masses of Thanksgiving, and now I'm back, so...
Oh, I bet they didn't want you to leave, right?
It was a great time to be back. It's always better to go back as a former pastor than a current pastor, but you're much more appreciated as a former pastor, I think. So
that's great. Absence makes the heart grow fonder,
right?
So I was wondering, can you tell me a little bit about, the synodal missionary style that the bishops say will be an important part of the bishop's work in leading the faithful? What does that look like? What does that mean?
It really is in response to Pope Francis's desire to be a more synodal church. So what he means by a synod is sort of walking together, that none of us have a monopoly on what we should do and how we should do it, and that we come with better solutions if we walk together and enter into dialogue and conversation together, that hopefully this mutual dialogue and walking together will lead us to creative solutions to a rapidly changing world.
Oh, that's great. And then how do you envision implementing the synodal missionary style in our parishes and other diocesan entities?
Well, it comes down to the leadership offered by the pastor himself in terms of adopting this synodal style in his own local parish. It involves a much more collaborative approach with his consultative bodies. I think all too often in our parish processes, we have sort of a committee structure that seems to have served the church for many, many years, but sometimes we can get bogged down into small details. But I think a synodal process really involves a mutual discernment that needs to take place so that a pastor in a local parish community can discern for themselves what their pastoral priority is going to be for their community, because the priority for their community, for their parish, might be very different than it would be for the neighboring parish. So, but a synodal process is not just on a parish level, it's also on a diocesan level. There was the beginning of the synod that just took place in Rome was preceding that was a process on each diocesan level for a diocesan-wide consultation, and there was a consultation here, and a very thorough one and a very good one that determined sort of three priorities for the church. And I think next year we're starting year three of that three-year journey. And all those goals and priorities came from that synodal process of dialoguing and listening to one another.
And it takes a lot of work, doesn't it?
It's a lot easier to have a committee meeting rather than a dialogue and a conversation. So
exactly. And so then I'm thinking, if Christoph Pierre, the papal nuncio to the U.S., he talked about Pope Francis's new encyclical. It's Latin, Dilexit Nos?
Dilexit Nos,
Dilexit
yes.
Nos.
He loves us.
On the Sacred Heart of Jesus, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so can you tell me, he said the encyclical is a call to return to the heart of Jesus and is essential to understanding the Church's call to synodal evangelization, Eucharistic revival, and the upcoming Jubilee. And so in 2025, how do you see that playing out?
Well, I would say the Sacred Heart is a very traditional Latin Catholic devotion, and Pope Francis has written an encyclical letter, but in a sense is bringing our attention to the notion of everything flows from the love of Christ, the Sacred Heart of Jesus is the heart is the place that we oftentimes associate love with, and It's the symbol of love is the heart. So it really is calling us into this relationship, this encounter, this personal encounter with Jesus Christ, and the love of Jesus Christ is where it all begins. And from that flows a desire to enter into relationship with people. So to enter into a relationship with one another. We have a tough time talking with people that we don't love, right? It's easier to have a relationship with people that we love. And so flowing from the heart of Jesus Christ and our encounter with the love of Jesus Christ, it changes everything. And
that's beautiful. And I mean, the way you're presenting it now makes so much sense then with this whole idea of the synodal process and how when you're talking about what that means to the love of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, that makes sense. It seems like it does tie together.
All love flows from Christ Himself, who is love Himself, right? The very essence of who God is love, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love that. So the bishops also talked about a new mission directive, evangelizing to those who are religiously unaffiliated or disaffiliated from the church, with special focus on young adults and youth. Mm-hmm. How do those priorities affect, you know, will that affect your approach to leading our diocese?
Well, the mission directive that was just passed by the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops was really an organizational priority for the USCCB. The structure of the USCCB is it's made up of many, many committees, but in order to align the efforts of all of those committees, there was a desire to have a mission directive that everything is subordinate to this mission directive that was just recently passed. So everything that the conference will do, I believe in the next 3 years, is seen through the lens of how does this affect youth and young adults, and how does it lead to a greater engagement of youth and young adults in the life of the church. So it's really an internal directive, an internal priority for the conference, directing all their work, that it's all seen in terms of how does it affect bringing in those youth and young people who feel disaffiliated and sort of distant from the church.
How does that reach out to us then in the parishes, for example? What do you see that?
Well, I think we could adopt the same priority if we want. I think I agree with the directive that people who feel sort of alienated and distant from the church are young people, and the number of people who sort of walk away from the church after high school and even more so after college is a huge number, a huge percentage of young Catholics, and sometimes they come back later on as adults. However, it's certainly something that brings to our attention this very critical issue of young people and how do you proclaim the gospel to young people? And
how do you do that?
I think it all comes through leading young people into an encounter with Jesus Christ. Right, it's back to the Sacred Heart again. So back to the Pope Francis's encyclical that it all flows from an encounter of love with Jesus Christ, and once we fall in love, it changes all aspects of our life. It changes everything about us in terms of what our heart seeks.
So do we go out and get them? I mean, because if they're not here, how do you encounter them?
My experience has always been that kids will evangelize their peers. You know,
okay.
The example that I've used in my own ministry has been, you know, when I was knocking my head against the wall for many years in terms of how to have an effective youth ministry program, and oftentimes we say that kids are overcommitted, and we say that it's athletics, it's sports, it's schoolwork, and that they're too engaged in other activities that they don't have time for church. They don't have time for engaging with youth group or anything else like that. And I've never been comfortable with those excuses. I change priorities. When I first started in one of my parishes, I think we had six kids coming to a youth group on a regular basis, and I knew that there were probably 2,000 kids of school age in the parish, and it just seemed to me that something was wrong. And what after I changed youth directors, and it was really youth ministry that changed my priesthood, and realized that it really all comes down to an encounter with Jesus Christ. And we started sending kids to summer camp, and many of these kids, I think we started with seven kids my first year, and seven kids became 15, and 15 became 35. And by the time I left the parish, there were probably 50 high school kids coming to youth group on a regular basis. And in the meantime, we also started a junior high group of about 75 kids. So what I learned from that, it's young people weren't coming to youth group because they were overcommitted. It's just that we weren't giving what they were interested in. And what they were interested in is coming into an encounter with Jesus Christ. And once that happened, they're the ones who evangelized their peers. They're the ones who invited their peers to youth group. They're the ones who invited their peers to summer camp and all these activities. So that's how it grew to, say, 120 people in the course of 5 or 6 years. Is it wasn't the work of the priest or even the youth minister. It was just leading that handful of teenagers into an authentic encounter with Jesus Christ that changes everything, and it sets them on fire, and it works from there. And that's what I experienced in my ministry anyway.
That is amazing. So is it that, you know, kids are at a pretty vulnerable time in their lives, and they want to know they're accepted and loved, and they
Correct.
Get that?
Yeah. You know, hearing confessions on at these youth camps, is just the extraordinary pressure that we place on children is just amazes me. You know, it's you know, to hear kids say, you know, I try and I work hard, and it never seems to be good enough for my parents and so forth, and just the extraordinary pressure that they feel that they're under, and to be able to have an encounter with the Lord who loves them just for who they are and not for what they do or what they. Mm-hmm. What expectations that people have for them, but just loves them because they are beloved, you know.
Oh, that's great. And then I'm wondering, now the Bishop Cousins talked about next steps, including the National Eucharistic Congress Board's efforts to work with parishes, or not parishes, I guess, with dioceses, that are conducting their own Eucharistic pilgrimages and congresses. I think we're having one here, aren't we? Or is that part of a national Eucharistic?
That's part of the national Eucharistic revival. So in the lead-up to Indianapolis, there was a pilgrimage procession that took place all throughout the country mm-hmm. that ended up in Indianapolis. Now they're reversing that procession. So they'll be coming through the diocese. I believe the plan right now is for Bishop Tilke in Peoria to process with the Eucharist to a bridge, and I'm supposed to meet him at the state line and to receive the monstrance and continue on into Davenport here. So, and it'll be going from Davenport. It'll be going to Dubuque after us. So.
Oh, that's exciting. Will that be like in May or something?
Not sure exactly when that's going to happen, but it will be happening. So I don't have an exact date when that's the date is set. It's just that I don't know it right now.
So we'll talk more about that at another
Correct.
Time.
Yeah.
But you see that as very helpful to this whole
I do.
Engaging.
Yeah. I think the experience of the National Eucharistic Congress that took place in Indianapolis was extraordinary in terms of excitement. I was not able to go only because I was sort of in transition in my current responsibilities as the Bishop of Davenport, so I wasn't able to go. However, it unleashed a lot of enthusiasm about the Eucharist and about the Church. So.
Okay.
So I think the desire is to possibly do another Eucharistic Congress again in the future. So.
And you see that as something that'd be very, very helpful.
I think so. I mean, I think there, they used to happen pretty regularly in the United States. I think they started in the 1920s. I think they stopped with the Second World War because of the war. So they have not been as regular since World War II. But it's trying to get back to a regular experience of Eucharistic congresses. So
that's very interesting. Can you tell me, too, at the USCCB meeting in November, about a week and a half ago, Bishop Mark Seitz, who chairs the USCCB's Committee on Migration, he encouraged the bishops and their priests to speak loudly and unified on the issue of migration, especially in light of the recent rhetoric from public figures. And I know Iowa's bishops just issued a statement of solidarity with their migrant brothers and sisters. What can you tell us about that statement? We've got it in the Catholic Messenger, but what can you tell us about that? The Iowa bishops' commitment to walking with migrants.
Sure, you know, first of all, the commitment of Bishop Seitz has been extraordinary. I mean, I heard Bishop Mark Seitz at Baby Bishop School in Rome. He came to talk about migrant ministry and migrants in general, reminding us that the whole issue of migration in the world is. Something that is very important to the Holy Father, Pope Francis, in terms of bringing the plight of millions and millions of people throughout the world who are migrating. And it calls our attention to the Church's teaching on migration and immigration. You know, the Church believes that everyone has the right to migrate, you know, so for whatever reason, whether it's to be able to provide for one's family, for work, for safety, security, to avoid war, that everybody has a natural right to migrate. And at the same time, governments have the right to regulate. But the situation here in the United States is something that is unique, and I think migration has been politicized on both sides let's say the aisle between with Democrats and Republicans, and it's Pope Francis says, you know, migrants are not political pawns. They shouldn't be used as political pawns. But in this highly charged political environment that we find ourselves, oftentimes migrants are becoming pawns in a political game, and it's unfortunate. And the narratives are told to scare people and to frighten people, and the climate right now for migrants is very, very difficult. So we need to remind people of our obligations to those who are next door, or whether whoever shows up at our door, we have a responsibility and obligation to care for them. So
it says in the letter that the letter is short and it's eloquent, but you talked about that we assure you of our prayerful support and ask the state of Iowa to do the same, and that you would do everything you could within the parameters of the law. The state of Iowa is coming down pretty hard on immigrants, and in fact wants to take over for the federal government and send them back.
Correct.
To the border.
And most likely it's political gamesmanship that's taking place. I mean, it's very likely that the law is questionable at best, and I'm sure the politicians who passed that are aware of that, and we'll see what the courts say about that. But it does have the effect of scaring people, and it's unfortunate that is the case. The Church uses the means at our disposal to advocate for migrants. We do that through the Iowa Catholic Conference. And on the state level, and the national bishops do it through the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. They do that on a federal level, and in terms of advocating for a more just treatment for migrants.
And does that include advocating in front of, like, the federal government? Well, I guess you've already written letters. I mean
it's advocacy through our legal. We have an immigration department here, the Diocese of Davenport, that is celebrating 50 years of ministry. So we help with the legal work of visas and immigration and all of that. but there's also advocacy toward legislatures and also government agencies. So it's not just a picketing or a protesting situation, but it's a direct advocating for meeting legislatures and government officials and pushing the position of the church in terms of a more just and humane treatment.
Do you think the bishops will make an appointment with Governor Reynolds?
That I don't know. We have legislative days coming up. Once a year, the bishops meet in Des Moines, and we meet legislators, and I'm not sure if that includes the governor or not. So
I think it does.
Okay.
So you can tell what you think.
This is my first go at it. So.
That's very good. And so just days after your USCCB meeting and with your fellow bishops, you headed to Iowa City for your clergy overnighter with the priests and deacons of our diocese. What were some of the highlights? What were your impressions? You know, what did you take away from that?
This is a large geographic area. The Diocese of Davenport is just a large area, and it's always good to have the opportunity where the priests can gather together as brothers and for some fraternity as well as some continuing education that takes place. So and every diocese does something different, but I think Davenport does this clergy overnight in November every year. Then we have a sort of a day of reflection around the Chrism Mass, and I believe in June they have a sort of a convocation.
Mm-hmm.
And each one has a special focus. This one is more continuing ed. The one in the Chrism Mass is much more spiritual. And I think the one in June is much more recreational. So it's a great opportunity to come together with brother priests and deacons and to just get to know each other better and to share fellowship with them. For the topic for this clergy overnighter, we had the topic was artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So the creator of, there's a website in the church called Magisterium AI, and it's basically about 16,000 church documents that are in the database, and it uses artificial intelligence, so you can ask it any question, and it'll give you the official position of the church. So you can ask it any question. So you can ask, what is synodality in Magisterium AI? And it will pull out an answer, and it'll tell you where it got the answer and where you should look for further information on those. So thank you. The website for that is magisterium.com. But he really talked more than just about magisterium.com. I mean, he talked about artificial intelligence in general and where it's going and what are the potential dangers of artificial intelligence.
What are some of the potential dangers?
I think all of our information is out there. And just as an example, when someone told me that artificial intelligence could take a papal document and summarize it in a nice 5 or 6 points, and so I put it to the test. I put in the Evangelii Gaudium, which is the Joy of the Gospel, written by Pope Francis. It's a very long encyclical. And I asked it for a summary of that, and it gave a wonderful summary of that. And then this was not on magisterium.com. It was on ChatGPT. The answer I got back was the summary of the document, and then there was a paragraph. And says, is there anything else that would be more helpful for your new diocese? So the question is, how did it know about my new diocese? So
wow.
I do have a Microsoft account, so it... I ask the founder of Magisterium AI how that happens. He says, well, artificial intelligence probably went out and did some research on you and brought that back into its answer. So it's pretty scary about what it's capable of doing.
Wow. What else can you tell it? Anything else from that meeting that really struck you? Or
About AI or about the clergy overnighter?
Either one.
Yeah, I'd say the AI is, he quotes a very knowledgeable person. He says that 10 to 20% of scholars think that AI has the potential to end us. So, but there's a percentage out there that it can be dangerous. So,
wow. And then, yeah, the other, how did you, relate with these new priests, and or well, they're not new. I guess they're new to you.
They're new to me, and getting to know them. And I had a memorial mass on Monday night for all the clergy, deacons, and their wives, and the priests who have died in the past year. So we did a memorial mass. So I had the opportunity to preach to the priests of the diocese. But we had shared dinner together, lunch, breakfast, and all those things. So it's a mixture of continuing ed and a fraternity. So,
and that's a good thing, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Were there some priests you had not met at this? Well,
there's quite a few priests that I haven't met yet. So I'm making an effort to get around to the diocese. Trying to meet priests one on one rather than as groups. Oftentimes in groups, people kind of hide a little bit, so they don't get a chance to talk or anything. And certainly that happened this last couple of days, where some people I didn't have the opportunity to talk to as I was talking to other people. So,
you'll say I'm going to search
I'm gonna find them eventually. So.
Eventually, that sounds good. What any other parting thoughts as we finish up this podcast?
I don't have anything right now off the top of my head. It's just. I've just been very impressed with the work that the U.S. bishops have done at the border. I met a lot of those bishops at the conference meeting last week, and all the bishops at the border on the U.S. side and the Mexican side. I didn't meet the Mexican bishops, but they are doing extraordinary work in trying to care for migrants, and so that they're not mistreated in any way, or they're not used or exploited in any way. So,
would that be something you would want to do? Go to the border?
I would be interested in going to the border to see for myself all the things that are happening. You know, one of the things that the bishops on the Mexican side and the American side is they have a mass in the middle of the Rio Grande River, where there's a platform that's put in the middle of the river, and there's a bridge on both sides of the river, and there's a mass for people on the Mexican side as well as the American side. So I'm fascinated by that. I hear the Border Patrol watches that mass very, very carefully. But I'm interested in possibly going down in the near future to be there when that happens. So
that sounds great. Well, Bishop, I appreciate another opportunity to have a Catholic Messenger conversation with you. And look forward to you're going to be doing this as a regular gig, right?
I presume so, yes.
This is great. We really appreciate it. So until next time, thanks. We appreciate your participation, and we appreciate our listeners, too.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.